a Democrat in the Senate race, Curtis Hill for governor, plus the latest school voucher report and more. From the television studios at WFYI, it's Indiana Week in Review for the week ending June 16th, 2023.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, former longtime alcohol lobbyist Mark Carmichael is Indiana Democrats' first candidate this cycle to announce a bid for U.S. Senate. Carmichael would face an uphill battle against the likely Republican candidate, Congressman Jim Banks. Carmichael spent nearly 5 years in the Indiana House of Representatives in the late 80s and early 90s. He also ran an unsuccessful campaign for Congress in 1996. Carmichael spent 2 decades as head of the Indiana Beverage Alliance, a trade association for beer distributors, before retiring in 2020. In a statement announcing his candidacy, the Democrat laid out 10 policy positions he'd work towards as a U.S. senator, chief among them codifying abortion rights. He says he'll also seek to ban, in his words, military-style assault weapons, take immediate action on climate change, and support LGBTQ youth. The last Indiana Democrat to win a race for U.S. Senate was Joe Donnelly more than a decade ago. Does Carmichael have any shot to beat Jim Banks? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Chris Mitchum. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, editor-in-chief of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House Bureau Chief Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, is Carmichael the kind of candidate who has a chance to upset Banks?
Well, I don't think anybody should underestimate Mark. I mean, remember, he beat a sitting Speaker of the House by hard work and was outraised by that Speaker as well. So you should never underestimate him. And there could not, if he's the nominee, there could not be a bigger contrast between the positions. He knows Joe Biden won the election. He knows those weren't tourists on January 6th. He doesn't think a 10-year-old should have to carry her rapist's fetus to term. Those things are going to mark, and he doesn't think automatic weapons ought to be issued to everybody and then wonder why the crime rate goes up. So I think you're going to see a marked positional contrast between the two of them, and I think that Mark's positions on these issues more reflect the average Hoosier than does Jim Banks, who is to the right of Attila the Hun on virtually every issue.
As I mentioned, an uphill battle here for any Democrat in this state running statewide at this point. We've seen that over the last several cycles. But is Mark Carmichael the kind of person that Democrats, A, know, or B, will get excited about?
It's the excited portion just because, I mean, he is very well known within the state house, within the lobbying world. I've had the opportunity to work with him. And I think he was very successful, especially in his role with the Indiana Beverage Alliance. A lot of the alcohol policies you see today is because of Mark Carmichael, going back to how
I don't know that
works.
That's going to help him necessarily with the average Hoosier.
I think
we'll
most Hoosiers drink, too.
Yeah. But to that point, he worked hard and he made that alliance what it is today. Now, I think from a political standpoint, I think he needs to kind of try to adopt more of the Joe Donnelly model. I know a lot of people can say that Joe Donnelly might have been a product of the environment whenever he was running. But, I mean, a lot of his stances, if you want to appeal to those people that may be turned off by the Banks, far right, January 6th, election fraud, all that kind of things, you're not going to do it by coming out and saying that I want Medicare for all, I think we should codify Roe v. Wade, and, you know, versus Joe Donnelly, who came out during his campaign and said, I don't want state-funded tax dollars to go to abortions. I think we should fund the border wall at the South. So I think it could call for a...
Codifying Roe v. Wade doesn't put state funding into abortion.
Well, I doubt that's something Joe Donnelly would come out and support.
Well,
though.
I don't think that Mark Carmichael supported state funding for abortions either.
No, but he is support codifying Roe v. Wade.
And I think most Hoosiers would agree with that in some form.
Let me ask this. It's the same sort of question, honestly, John, which is, you know, I think Chris just hit it on the head. Mark Carmichael is a name that those of us around this table know very well. Maybe some of the viewers of this show know very well. But if you go outside of that, I don't think he's going to be a household name. Now, there's a long time until the election. Is he the sort of candidate who can build up name recognition and get people excited about his candidacy?
I think you have to have the foundation that you just described, the ability to ring the cash register, the ability to put together a grassroots organization, because this is a big state, and you can't just rely on a commercial here and a commercial there. An air war is powerful, but it's not the only game in town. So there are two kind of candidates. I'm sure there's somebody in the middle, but there are those who have great name ID and think they can just waltz into office based on their name ID, say they come out of the realm of business or sports or whatever. But they get there and they realize, oh, I got to make money or ring the cash register. I have to put together an organization. I have to do all this stuff. Or you have the candidate who may not have a high name recognition at this point statewide among Hoosier voters, but who knows how to do all those things and can call in the IOUs and does have that sort of respect within the governmental and political arena. I think that's probably more important. That latter, and he would have that. I mean, and he's been around. He's collected a lot of IOUs. I'm old enough to remember covering him when he was in the House. And that photo that everybody, those who were watching on television, probably giggled at. That's how I still remember him. So,
I think the problem for Democrats, and this is, I mean, it's not a shock to anybody, is listening to John just describe those two types of candidates. I think Democrats have seen those two types of candidates run for the U.S. Senate in recent years. One of them, the first one, was Evan Bayh. Tons of name recognition. Didn't run a very good campaign in 2016. And then you had Joe Donnelly, who actually had name recognition, but more than that, knew how, already had an organization in place and knew how to build it out, worked as hard as any human being can work at that job and at that campaign, and he still lost. So realistically, do Democrats have a shot at this seat?
Uphill battle is a nice way to say it. Obviously, like, I had a number of Democrats reach out who have no idea who Mark Carmichael is. I mean, outside this sort of small fishbowl, he's a complete unknown in most of the state. So, I mean, he's going to have a ton of IOUs to make that happen.
Well,
I am hoping, though, that, I mean, maybe he'll at least level up the debate a little, you know, with Banks and try to, you know, get at some, make Banks basically work hard for it and maybe have to moderate
and
a
think Jim Banks is willing to work hard. There's no evidence to the contrary.
But his positions are not what the average Hoosier wants. And I think if to the extent that Mark raises
they,
the
but
money...
But are they at this point what the average Hoosier voter wants? Because are two different populations.
I know that, but I still think if you, for example, on the 10-year-old, I think if you polled on that, the Democratic position on that would win, okay? Hands down. And yet... Banks is going to articulate a position that abortions.
You could say the same thing the other way. If you poll on transgender sports, for instance, it polls the Republican way, you know, regardless of whether
fewer people
are going to cast their vote only on transgender sports.
You know what? It doesn't.
More women are going to
think
cast
that
their
voters
vote on road.
Are out there, you know, thinking about reflecting on their views and coming to some sort of mental consensus about what should take place in our society, and then they compare that with the candidate. That doesn't happen. I mean, basically, people emerge from under the rock, a lot of people, and then they go and they...
Well, that's true, the Republican candidates.
And then they say R or D.
Numbers.
I mean, and that's what, sadly, what it comes down to.
All right. Well, speaking not of the Senate race, but now the governor's race, former Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill recently told the Associated Press he's considering a run for governor. Hill was defeated in his re-election bid for AG in 2020 after the Indiana Supreme Court said he criminally battered four women. Hill also lost in a Republican caucus last year to replace Congresswoman Jackie Walorski after her death. In a statement to the AP, the former Elkhart County prosecutor said Indiana needs a strong conservative who has the guts to challenge what he called the Indianapolis status quo. If he runs, Hill would join an already crowded Republican field that includes U.S. Senator Mike Braun, Lieutenant Governor Suzanne Crouch, Fort Wayne businessman Eric Doden, and Jamie Rittenour. Chris Mitchum, this is not like it's a wide open primary. Governor Holcomb is term limited, but there's already some real big names in it. Is there a path for Curtis Hill in this primary?
There's a path. There's always a path for anybody to hops in. But how wide that path is certainly up for discussion. And I think the path you saw when in the second congressional district to replace Jackie Walorski, Curtis Hill finished in second. Now, he did get into the race kind of late, and he finished a distant second. But that shows you that he has a base. The people that still are still familiar with him when he ran for AG and when he got the most votes in the state for that race, he has a base. Now, can he translate that base to the governor's race? I'm not sure. I personally believe if it wasn't for his past transgressions, you could be talking about the front runner, Curtis Hill, because that's just how popular he was. So can he translate that to the governor's race? I'm not sure, and you have a lot of money already in that race, a lot of people that already have kind of taken the sides on the political spectrum. Where would he come in? Would he push it further right? Most likely, because that's kind of where he got his credibility in the first place, was being further right on these social issues, which could kind of access a new pot of money for him, per se. So there's certainly a path, but it may be a little too late just by how established the three front runners already are.
I completely agree with Chris when he says, you know, if not for the transgressions, I think he would be the front runner, absolutely, because he was incredibly popular and a rising star. But, and it's a very large but, those transgressions are going to weigh him down. Are they enough to weigh him down to keep him out of
Well, Republicans have a bit of a history of nominating gropers. If we remember the tapes from Donald Trump's first run in Hollywood. So I don't think it's going to necessarily be a detriment. And whenever you have a primary that is that wide open and you have a finite amount of voters in there, anything can happen. And is it possible they would nominate him after what the Supreme Court said about him criminally abusing women? Absolutely.
Does Curtis Hill have a path in the primary?
Ooh, I think if Braun or Crouch weren't in, yes. But I don't know how he overcomes their money that they've raised, their name ID, and, of course, the issues with him, you know, harassing, touching women inappropriately. I don't see him getting past the front runners.
To me, the biggest thing here is, I mean, I think Chris articulated it, which is there is, you know, if you think about Suzanne Crouch on the political campaign, on the trail, has been trying to tack right. Because that's a position she's never really articulated before now. Mike Braun is Mike Braun. Eric Doden, not hard right, nope. Certainly not in what he says.
And the outsider.
Yeah, and the outsider. But there is a hard right base that Curtis Hill already has quite a lot of influence with. But the money. You're facing self-funders and people who are going to gobble up a lot of just... There's a finite number of voters. There's also a finite number of amount of cash. Realistically, that's going to be put into this race.
But you can reach that finite universe without television. It's not big.
But is he going
to
be able to compete?
He needs to get in now.
Yeah. Is he going to be able to compete?
Well, you're right about money. You hate to say that money is everything, but it is a big thing, certainly in a statewide race. He's not able to self-fund, I don't think, unless he's won the lottery since we last spoke. So that puts him at a bit of a disadvantage. Getting into the game a little bit, quote-unquote, late.
Yeah, what used to be right on time.
The new rules. Yeah. But, you know, there is, somebody alluded to this, there's an inverse correlation between predictability and number of people in the race. Right. And just when you think you have something figured out, the more people get into that race, the predictability, the certainty goes opposite direction.
Yeah, it's not like you're shooting for 50% of that. Yeah.
Right, because then all of a sudden you're just looking at plurality.
How dedicated your 30% is. That's what counts.
And you see all kinds of horse trading. You know, it's I'll back out, I'm going to support you, I'll bring my people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And you do wonder how much his past transgressions did have an impact in that second congressional kind of private GOP race. Because when he was asked about it, right, even dating back to the AG's office, he just said, it's fine. I mean, it wasn't fine, but, you know, that's in the past. We can move past that, and I'm not sure maybe if he tries to take a different approach of how to maybe try to kind of come back
address
to that.
Address it more directly.
Yeah, to the address that people
I mean, cause
could be in
to your point, he had a solid little base of support in that second district precinct caucus, or in that caucus, but it was a distant second. I mean, Rudy Yakim won on the first ballot in a large field of candidates, which is hard to do with that many candidates in a private caucus. So we'll see. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we post an unscientific online poll question. And this week's question is, can Curtis Hill win the Republican nomination for governor? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question was, will Micah Beckwith be the GOP nominee for lieutenant governor? 14% of you say yes, 86% say no. I'm not sure I'm quite as confident of that. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Indiana's voucher program to pay for student tuition at private and religious schools cost more taxpayer money than last year. WFYI's Eric Weddle reports students who received vouchers are also less racially diverse than the previous year.
The school voucher program was originally intended to help low-income students. In the past decade, the state's Republican majority expanded eligibility. A new state report describes the average student now using a voucher as white and coming from a home with an income of $81,000. Indiana's median household income is much less than that. The report says more than 53,000 students used a voucher last school year. The program cost the state more than $300 million. Next month, a new law will make nearly all students eligible for a voucher.
Thank you, Kelly. Quite frankly, especially after what the legislature just did this past session, does it matter anymore who the voucher program serves?
I mean, it matters in the sense of we need to know where the state dollars are going. I mean, for all intents and purposes, after the new law goes into effect July 1, it covers virtually every child in the state.
Except the wealthiest of the wealthy.
Correct. But, yeah, virtually. It's like 3% that it won't cover. Yeah. So, but I do think it is important for us to know who we're giving the money to. I mean, you know, if it ends up skewing even more all white, all rich, all, you know, suburban, you know, I mean, at some point, it's an unfunded liability that's going to rival, that's just going to keep rivaling the other, and so our traditional public schools. So I hope that lawmakers read these reports, although I'm pretty sure they would, at least Republicans, would be pretty happy with it.
Yeah, to that point, in the sense that it doesn't matter who it serves, I guess the way I'll ask it to you, which is, to Republicans, does it matter who it serves as long as whoever wants it gets it?
Not to the people who envisioned this whole thing back, you know, a decade ago and were the architects of it. I think they'd be very happy to see it be truly universal, which, again, for all practical purposes, it is. And if that means that families, well-heeled families, are sending kids to private school using vouchers and they would have gone to those same schools otherwise, so be it. The question is, you know, there isn't any... You know, people are, one of the arguments we heard this session was it's what, 93% of people go to public school. So we're only talking about 7%. Well, there's no cap. There are no guidelines.
I remember when that was 2%.
Right. Yeah. Theoretically, I mean, let's play in theory. If you had enough people getting into the education business and they tend to draw the dollars in education, tend to get people into the game, you could have 80%. Again, not likely.
You could
have it the other direction.
Yeah.
And then you don't roll it back because that's the real challenge.
Yeah.
Good luck to anybody who goes and tells people, especially the well-heeled individuals who have political clout and can say, you're trying to take away this hard-earned benefit.
It's not hard-earned.
Let me ask this. This breakdown was largely about who the student is. But is the more important question, especially now that it is virtually universal, is the more important question going to be outcomes? Are we actually serving these students that we are giving public dollars to as well as we could be if they were being served in a public school?
There was a push for that, right? I mean, Senator Ryan Mishler, the chairman of the Appropriations Committee, basically said he's not the biggest fan of this because there's no accountability. There's no outcome. We need to be focusing on these outcomes. And as of right now, I don't see the outcomes necessary in order to have this huge expansion of eligibility. So I definitely think there is a voice, not only Senator Mishler, but maybe those in the Senate caucus, and maybe even some in the House Republicans as well, that want to focus on the outcomes. And information like this is never bad. Yeah, it's exactly kind of what we expected, you know, more wealthy, typically more white people getting more involved in this. But I'm hoping with these numbers, we can also start talking about outreach and how, you know, if we do see that maybe the black population, you know, compared to the white person, disproportionately, it's not raising fast enough. That's where we can kind of start, ideally, targeting those demographics to try to push this program further.
This is a classic bait and switch for Republican. Remember when this started? It was supposed to take poor kids out of failing schools. That's what it was supposed to do. Where are we now? We're now going to be subsidizing Park Tutor is what we're going to be doing. Okay?
Park Tutor doesn't take vouchers.
Oh, okay. Well, then For now.
That's on the rise as well.
But that issue aside, I don't understand why rural Republicans put up with this. You know, you don't have choice in a lot of these rural counties. And what they're doing is taking money from the institutions that these people in rural counties value, their schools, and you're taking it away to put it into metropolitan areas for rich people.
And for the first time in the more than decade since we finally saw that start to rear its head in the Senate Republican caucus this year. But let me ask you this, Nikki. Because we just talked this week, the Legislative Council met. We talked to Senator Rod Bray and Speaker Todd Houston about some things. And one of the things that Roderick Bray said, because it was one of the study committees, is the thing that keeps him up at night is Medicaid. It's the fastest growing part of the Indiana budget.
Till now.
And that's, that's absolutely true, certainly in the dollars. But if we're talking about percentage increases, the fastest growing part of the budget is the voucher program. And that doesn't seem, the Senate's a little different than the House.
I mean, let's be fair. They're Republicans, and so they're going to be more concerned about a program that's helping people they don't think are their voters than a program that is helping their voters.
All right. General Motors this week finally announced a multi-billion-dollar investment to build its electric vehicle battery plant in St. Joseph County. WBPE's Marek Mazurek reports on the decision's impact.
General Motors and Samsung will build a battery plant on nearly 660 acres of land in western St. Joseph County, the companies announced on Tuesday. Estimates for the plant call for a $3.5 billion investment that will create thousands of construction jobs and around 1,600 full-time jobs once the plant is completed. Jeff Ray, who's the president of the South Bend Regional Chamber of Commerce, called the project a game-changer for the region's economy.
The wages alone will generate an economic impact of over $600 million a year, which is phenomenal. And so never in our lifetime have we seen a project that has that kind of an impact.
Construction is expected to start this year, and the plant could be operational by 2026.
John Schwanis, there was also news recently that 91 out of 92 Indiana counties trail the national average in wages. Only Marion County is just barely above the national average. Even accounting for cost of living, Indiana's not doing well. So how big is a project like this toward reversing some of that trend?
Well, it's certainly big in the county. I mean, now it'll be 90 versus 2, instead of 91 versus 1. No, you love to see these kinds of announcements, and you hope we see more of these sorts of things. The onus now is on the state, and this is not a surprise to the administration and others who have said we have to make sure we have a workforce that can adapt to these companies that come in with relatively high-paying jobs and so forth. We can't be in a situation where people show up, we like your incentives, you know, thank you, state, for helping smooth the path. We're here, hang out the sign, help wanted, and nobody who's qualified shows up. So that's where the part two of the challenge is.
To that end, we've talked a lot about that issue. The legislature talks a lot about that issue. The governor talks a lot about that issue. But at the same time, you still have companies like this announcing this, and at the same time this week also, I think it was the GM plant in Fort Wayne is going to invest more than $600 million to build out the plant they already have there that's going to be looking at electric vehicle manufacturing. That's the future. So at the same time these companies are saying, hey, you need to really focus on this, they're also coming here. What message should we be taking away from that?
Well, I mean, Indiana's not the only one struggling with workforce issues. That's so true. Obviously, you know, they're making their decision based on a host of factors, not just that one. I will say, you know, having watched announcements like this for the last 25 years, there's always another announcement like this. But those wage numbers are really frustrating because despite announcement after announcement after announcement, we don't seem to ever move the needle in a way that helps Hoosiers
We're still 91
in comparison
out of
to the
counties.
Other right. counties, yeah, so or the other sure. states.
So this is unquestionably good news.
Right.
How do we move the needle when we're getting these sorts of announcements? And this is not in isolation. We keep getting announcements.
Well,
like
and
this.
If we're going to continue to be the state that works for less, we've got to do something different. And part of that comes from education. We ought to be funding pre-K education in this state. We should have been doing it 10 years ago. And yet now, when you can get a voucher making $220,000 a year, you can't get a preschool voucher if you're making less than 30?
Yeah.
Or more than 30, excuse me. It's ridiculous.
I will say that it does seem like there is that gap exists, but there seems to be a recognition at the State House that finally we need to be doing, you know, rising tide lifts all boats.
But we do it with little Lego
steps. All right,
finally,
Purdue and Indiana University officials this week formally agreed to separate IUPUI into two campuses next year, IU Indianapolis and Purdue Indianapolis. Now, Anne Delaney, there's still going to be an athletics program, but it seems like it should get a new name and mascot. So what should it be?
Well, first of all, this is a great thing for Indianapolis. And Richard Luger pushed for this 30 years ago. And when we talk about Lego steps, I don't know that they needed a mascot at all. I mean, IU's got the candy stripe and served them pretty darn well. Maybe they could do it horizontally instead of vertically.
Horizontal candy stripes instead of vertical. I'm not sure there's enough distinct branding.
Doesn't make you look
Nikki,
thin.
Nikki, you had one for us.
I mean, Fort Wayne went with the Mastodon, so I think maybe following that tradition, maybe the fireflies, because we did state insect. Though I don't think that's very like menacing or.
I don't know. You can make a menacing firefly.
In Stanford, you have the trees, which is hardly menacing.
Yeah, that's
too.
True. How about the capitals? I mean, it is a capital city. It's right near the state house.
As an IUPUI grad, I'm disappointed. But the Speedway is right there. Let's connect the two. Something like that.
Something like that.
No, the Racers were the hockey team.
It's
asking
for the Checkers. I just stole all those names from past teams.
Let's go back to the candy stripes.
That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Chris Mitchum, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Indiana Capital Chronicle. You can find Indiana Week in Review's podcast and episodes at wfyi.org/IWIR or on the PBS app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.